Today's date is August 20th, 1997. The speaker is Carol Berkland. The topic is genocide in Rwanda. What really happened and why? Number one.
This event. Let me begin by asking you, did you know about this when it was happening? Can you think back to April, May, June, July of 1994? Do you remember it? Could I ask you what you recall from that time? Do you remember how you felt about it or what you thought was going on? What were your impressions, if you had any, at the time? You must have seen it on television, right?
I remember hearing about the plane crash that killed one country, a neighboring country's president.
Yeah, it was both the president of Rwanda and Burundi. They were both in the plane that was shot down.
And then after that, it just seemed like week after week, the stories just got worse and worse.
Yeah.
Coming out there. I remember some magazine with their bodies floating down the river.
Right, yeah.
There were stories of
Real brutality, of real terrible butchering brutality, yeah. Anybody else about the general impression that everyone had?
My general impression was that it was tribal, mm-hmm. from when I got off the evening news, because
right.
I'm using the Tutsis for
right.
seemed like yeah. an old tribal.
An old tribal problem. Yeah, I think that's what a lot of people felt. I was in Geneva then, and saw the same thing that everybody else saw. And I must tell you that even though I'm in a rather privileged position in terms of having contacts with that part of the world, I must tell you that in the beginning, I thought the same thing too. I thought, you know, oh my goodness, are they going at each other again? You know, what is going on here? Is this just another replay of another, as the newspapers, as the media portrayed it, kind of a spontaneous outbreak of tribal violence in Africa? I mean, we've seen it before. We've seen how long does this have to go on, et cetera, et cetera. The other thing that I remember is that my office is across the hall from our emergency director, who was at that time a Danish man who had a lot of experience in Africa. And I can remember our offices, if our doors are open, we can hear the telephone conversations of other staff members. And I remember hearing this absolutely incredible conversation, at least one side of it, in which the field office in Tanzania, the World Service field office in Tanzania, was asking if we could find some people who were like mountain climbers, who were alpinists, who would have the ability, the physical ability, to go down some of these very steep cliffs along the river, where, as you said, the bodies, where we started seeing the bodies floating down, because they needed to have someone who could go down there and with hooks and other ropes and start pulling some of these bodies out, because they were collecting in certain parts of the river. And I just found that astonishing. And after I heard the conversation, I went in and said, what in the world is going on here? So that's my memory of it. And then I started hearing people saying, no, this wasn't just what the news media had initially reported. It wasn't just an issue of two African tribes going at each other in a kind of mindless violence. So that's what I'd like to talk about today, so we get some kind of understanding of exactly what happened. First, let's talk about where Rwanda is. I have a map here. Africa. Rwanda is really a very small country. It's about the size of our state of Maryland, so you can see it's not a very large country. In 1991, the population of Rwanda was judged to be about 7.1 million. And there's a lot of population pressure on the land, high birth rates. The population of Rwanda doubles every 20 years. It's located here in what we call the Great Lakes area of East Central Africa. Burundi is right below it. Rwanda is above. Both countries, the population of both countries are a combination of both the Hutu tribe and the Tutsi tribe. It's surrounded by Zaire here, Tanzania here, and Uganda in the north. And in terms of the refugee flows that were generated as a result of the genocide, in the beginning, most of the refugees went this way, went east toward Tanzania, and the LWF, Lutheran Federation, has an office, for many years has had an office in Tanzania, so we right away started being involved with the UN High Commissioner for Refugees to deal with the approximately 250,000 refugees across the border here. Later on, after the Tutsi-Rwandan Patriotic Front pressed down from Uganda into Rwanda, then you saw a tremendous number of refugees going this way in above Lake Kivu into Zaire. There, that group was about the 800,000 that you saw later. So that's the situation. That's where it's located. There's an excellent book which I would recommend, and I'm going to leave it behind. If any of you, I'm leaving on Saturday, and I'm going to leave the book behind, so if any of you are interested, it will be here next week. It's called A Season of Blood, A Rwandan Journey. It's written by a man named Fergal Keane, who is a BBC correspondent. He's now in Hong Kong. It's the best book that I've seen, and it won last year, or 2 years ago, 1995 Orwell Prize, which is the best prize for, I think, the best political book of the year. I'd like to start the presentation by reading just a bit from this book. Keane was, as I said, is a BBC correspondent, and he had been down in South Africa covering the elections after the multi-party situation in South Africa, first open and free elections, including the black population of South Africa. And it was at that time that the story started coming through that something very terrible was happening in Rwanda. This is what he says. In the second week of April, this is 1994, film began to arrive in Johannesburg for transmission to British and American television networks. Much of the material seemed to be coming from the border between Rwanda and Tanzania at the Rusumo Falls Bridge, across which tens of thousands of refugees were pouring every day. There were some fearful pictures coming out of Kigali, mounds of bodies and roadblocks manned by machete-wielding gangs. The general consensus among those of us watching the pictures and those who had taken them was that Rwanda was a madhouse, excuse me, a primitive torture chamber where rival tribes were busy settling ancient scores. I could not, watching the apocalyptic images unfolding on the video screens, imagine Rwanda as a country in its own right, a place with cities and schools and universities, with a wide diversity of media and political organizations, a country with musicians and poets. The idea that the madness might have been planned, that it was the direct result of political scheming, was far from my thoughts. And then he makes a general comment, which I think can really inform our entire discussion. And that's about how the media not only covered the genocide in Rwanda, but how the media deals with much of Africa. In our world of instant televised horror, it can become easy to see a black body in almost abstract terms, as part of the huge smudge of eternally miserable blackness that has loomed in and out of the public mind through the decades. Biafra in the 60s, Uganda in the 70s. We are fed a diet of starving children, of stacked corpses, and battalions of refugees, and in the end we find ourselves despising the continent of Africa. There's another quote from a very good human rights organization, Africa Watch. Where television is concerned, African news is generally only big news when it involves lots of dead bodies. The higher the mound, the greater the possibility that the world will, however briefly, send its camera teams and correspondents. Once the story has gone stale, that is, there are no new bodies and new refugees are down to a trickle, the circus moves on. The images leave us horrified but largely ignorant. We have compassion without understanding. This is a kind of journalism that is driven by stories of horror, but markedly lacking in analysis or historical content. I think that's a good, very good description of what happened. Let's start by a definition. What do we mean by genocide? And I think here the most important word is the word systematic. I looked up the dictionary for a good definition. Genocide is the systematic killing of or a program of action intended to destroy a whole national or ethnic group. Keep that in mind. Here are some startling statistics. The cost in human lives. Within a period of 3 months, an estimated 500,000 to 800,000 people were killed as a result of civil war and genocide in Rwanda. Large numbers were physically and psychologically afflicted for life through maiming, rape, and other trauma. Over 2 million fled to neighboring countries, and maybe half as many became internally displaced within Rwanda. The human suffering was really incomprehensible. What it cost in terms of dollars. During the 9 months of the emergency, that's 1994, April to December, international assistance for emergency relief to Rwandese refugees and displaced persons, it's estimated at a cost of $1.4 billion. And that covers only really the 9 months of the emergency. As you well know, the refugees, the 800,000 in Zaire and the 300,000 in Tanzania did not go home. The refugees in Zaire started going home only last year, I think about October, November, and the refugees in Tanzania started going back in the spring. And I do not know the cost to the international community or to the UN for the support of those at least a million people for more than 2 years. So in terms of the cost of lives and of dollars, is just immense. Okay, so who are the Tutsis and who are the Hutu? In today's Rwanda, or even let's say 10 years ago, the Hutu have always been the majority. And in most cases, that percentage is about 80% to 20%. 80% Hutu to 20% Tutsi. The Hutu tribe came into Rwanda perhaps 1000 BC. Even before the Hutu was a tribe called the Twa. The Twa are essentially pygmies from Central Africa, and they are believed to have lived in Rwanda from about the year 2000 BC. The Hutu came about 1000 years later, and it is believed that they came probably from Central Africa, perhaps up here, Central African Republic, Cameroon, whatever, that they came from this area. And the Hutu have always been traditionally farmers. They came after the Twa. As I said, the Hutus were farmers. Later, the Tutsi came. And the Tutsi were also farmers, but many of them were also cattle herders. And as is the case all over Africa, and we can even see it in our own country, in our history, those people who have livestock always are a little bit better off than those people who are farmers. If you remember stories from the West, the sodbusters, it's that those people who are cattle herders are somehow think themselves higher on the social scale than the people who till the land. And that's exactly how it started with the Hutu and the Tutsis. The Hutu were the majority, but they were the farmers. The Tutsi were the minority, but they were cattle herders, and they therefore had access to more wealth. It's interesting, though, that since the Hutu were there first, when the Tutsis came, they adopted the Hutu language. They adopted much of the culture of the Hutus, so that in a way, it was very difficult to tell the difference between the two groups. They spoke the same language. They had much of the same culture, cultural traditions. There was intermarriage. But there continued to be, over time, this distinction between the two groups, the Tutsis being the minority, but the more powerful, the Hutus being the majority, but the underclass. What separated them, as I said, was primarily a matter of occupation and wealth. There also became kind of a client relationship where a wealthy Tutsi would hire a Hutu, would perhaps give that person a cow or a goat or two cows or two goats, some bit of livestock. But that was done with the idea that then that person worked for the landlord, for the Tutsi. So there was, a stratification in the society. However, the difference was not totally stratified. Some Hutus managed through time to build up some wealth and to acquire livestock. So what you saw was a situation where instead of necessary ethnicity, which divided these two groups, it was a very materialist society that was, if you were wealthy, you were a Tutsi. If you were not very wealthy, you were Hutu. And there were even instances where people could kind of move from one class. They could go up, they could become Tutsi, or they could, if they fell on hard times, they could become a Hutu. Now come some interesting things, which I think, and I hear this from a lot of my African friends, when the refugees came to Tanzania, the Hutu refugees came to Tanzania, of course most of them, the bulk of them stayed in the refugee camps, but some of them managed to go over and end up in Dar es Salaam. And a good friend of mine who works for the Tanzanian church said to me, well, you know that there's some Hutus here in Dar es Salaam. And I said, well, how do you know? He said, oh, you can see, you can tell. Don't you know? You can tell. You just look at them. You can see the difference. The Hutus were by and large short and stocky, and the Tutsis by and large were tall and slender. And this idea of height and slenderness and short and stocky, again, you know, it goes the same way. If you're tall and slender and you have rather aquiline features, you somehow are superior. And if you're short and stocky and do not have this kind of aquiline Western features, European features, then you're the underclass. It's amazing, but it was certainly there. There developed a dangerous second-class citizenship among the Hutus, not only in terms of their economic status in society, but another very strange thing, which was then manipulated very well by the colonists who came to Rwanda. As is usually the case in a colonial situation, when a colonial power comes in, it has to use a certain element or a certain group within the local society to help it govern. Now, in terms of Rwanda, the Germans were the original colonists of Rwanda, and this happened because in the late 1800s, 1899, there was a famous conference in Berlin where literally Africa was divided up between the European colonial powers, and Germany got Rwanda. Germany also got Tanzania, or at that point it was called Tanganyika. After World War I, things changed, and the Belgians took over Rwanda. After World War II, Rwanda remained under a protectorate of Belgium through the League of Nations. But anyway, let's go back to this strange issue of what is called the notion of the Hamites. And I find this to be extremely strange. It suited the early colonists to believe in and foster a myth that the Tutsis, who they had chosen as the minority and the privileged minority to help them rule, that the Tutsis were not really black, they were not really Africans, they were not really Rwandans, that they were people who were not dissimilar to Europeans. In many cases, the Tutsis have a lighter complexion. They're not as black as the Hutus. And the idea was that these kind of people had come from the north. They had come from Ethiopia or Sudan. And if you've ever seen an Ethiopian or a Sudanese, you understand why somebody might make that connection. Ethiopians are very tall. Sudanese are very tall. They are lighter complexion. They have more aquiline features, etc. So this was the myth that the Tutsis were not really Africans, but they were people, as I said, not dissimilar to Europeans. The truth is, of course, that this is a myth. The Europeans, and here we have, unfortunately, also missionaries, church people, they linked physical characteristics with mental capacity. The Hamites, these people, the Tutsis were supposed to be these Hamites, were supposed to be born leaders, and they were cousins of the Europeans. It's a quote here, the Tutsis, they resemble the Negro only in the color of their skin. But before becoming black, these people were just tanned. Can you imagine? They were just somehow tanned, and then they got a little blacker. No. In stature, the Tutsi resembles most closely that of a white person rather than that of a Negro, which in fact, it would not be an exaggeration to state that he is a European who happens to have black skin.
Wow.
Yeah. Here's a quote from a Belgian doctor. The Hamites, meaning these Tutsis, have a distinct, reserved, courteous, and elegant manner. The rest of the population is Bantu, shorter, stockier people, the Bahutu. They are Negroes. With all the Negroid characteristics, they are childish in nature, both timid and lazy, and as often as not, extremely dirty. So, here you have already existing within the society from, I don't want to say time immemorial, but let's say 1,000 years, the idea with that the Hutus as the minority are in fact superior. I mean, that cleavage already exists within the society, within Rwanda. And then come the colonists, the Belgians, who invent a lot of these myths about the superiority of the Tutsis because it is in their best self-interest to use the Tutsis, who already think of themselves as being superior, as carrying out the colonial agenda. So you can see this is a recipe for disaster. It's just one thing built on the other. Obviously, sooner or later, this had to end. The Tutsis had instituted a monarchy. There were a series of Tutsi kings. And frankly, they dealt with the Hutus in a very harsh way. If the Hutus rebelled, if the Hutus decided that they didn't like the situation, they were dealt with very harshly. And there are stories certainly at the end of the last century, the beginning of this century, of massacres that the Tutsis carried out against the Hutus, because of course they were the power. They had they controlled the army. They controlled the government. Their word was law. Unfortunately, the Catholic Church also had a hand in this, because they made mission schools. One of the things that a lot of missionaries did in the earlier days, brought education, had schools. Those schools were usually only open to the Tutsis, not to the Hutus. So again, you have a situation where an outside element is providing education, providing opportunity only for the minority in the country, more or less ignoring the majority. The Hutu received only the education required for working in the mines and working in industry, but not anything that would allow them to perhaps move upward in society. One of the very important things that happened that had devastating effects during the genocide was the fact that in the 1930s, the Belgians introduced a system of identity cards where everybody had an identity card. And on that card, you were identified either with an H or with a T, as a Hutu or as a Tutsi. And when the killing began, when the genocide began, a lot of the killing happened at roadblocks. Roadblocks were put up right away, and anyone coming to that roadblock was asked to show their identity card. And if there was a T, they were just killed outright at the roadblock. It was just, there was no questions asked. If you were a Tutsi, you were dead. So in summary, the monopolization of power was in the hands of the Tutsi, and this constituted a crucial and undisputed factor by firmly establishing a structure of ethnic cleavage. The colonial intervention caused the groups to become distinct political categories. Before, they were only ethnic categories, but then they also became political categories. Colonial policies merely grafted onto a foundation that already contained a potential for conflict. So we were building, the pressure was building up. In the 50s and 60s, as most of you know, the winds of change were blowing across Africa, and many African countries were, or colonial countries were, striving for their independence. The same was happening in Rwanda. The Belgians at this point were not stupid. They realized that if independence came to Rwanda, there would probably be elections, and the Hutu, who were clearly the majority of the country, would win any election. And in order to ensure the fact that they would continue to have some kind of influence in Rwanda after independence, they then did a total flip-flop and abandoned the Tutsis as the minority and backed the Hutu as the majority. By this time, also, the Hutus were getting pretty fed up with this situation. And in 1957, they issued something which is called the Bahutu Manifesto. And this was it was an unfortunate time, because there's sometimes certain periods in history where you could see things going one way, and if they went that way, things would have worked out a little better in the end, or they can go the other way. And in this case, it was a convergence of these circumstances, which if it had gone the other way, would have probably meant that we would have not had a genocide 40 years later. But anyway, the Hutu had suffered so long under this system of repression that they decided that they issued this manifesto, which simply said, when we're an independent country, instead of saying we'll share power with the Tutsi, what they said is the Tutsis don't belong here. They have no right to be here. We are the only true Rwandans. And they used as a justification for this view that old Hamite myth where the colonialists had said the Tutsis were not Rwandans, that they had come from Sudan or Ethiopia or Europe or whatever. And this was a very unfortunate thing because, as I said, there was a chance there at independence to form a country which would have included both ethnic groups. But because of this history of repression and the anger, the pent-up anger of the Hutu majority, they totally ignored the Tutsis. Not only did they ignore them, they just said they have no right to be here. And it was interesting, when the genocide began, the Kagera River, which is this river where all of these, many of the bodies were thrown, the Kagera River flows back into Lake Victoria and from there goes north into Ethiopia and ends up as being part of the Blue or White Nile. And you heard people saying, throw the Tutsis in the river and send them back to Ethiopia. So that old myth of the Hamite came back to really haunt the Tutsis. Because, as I said, this manifesto simply discounted the Tutsis. It said, it was one of those awful things where it becomes like a zero-sum game. Whatever is good for the Tutsis is bad for the Hutus. Whatever is good for the Hutus is bad for the Tutsis, et cetera, et cetera. So that possibility of putting together a country that might involve both ethnic groups was dashed. And that's also dangerous because then you have a situation where you have political groups. The Hutu become one political group, the Tutsi become the other political group, and you can see that in places like Northern Ireland and other places that once you stratify or once you define political groups on the basis of ethnicity, you're really in trouble because there's very little possibility for movement back and forth. If you are a Hutu, you are this party. If you are a Tutsi, you are that party. And those two parties are always in conflict. There were parliamentary elections in September of 1961 after independence, and as could be understood, the Hutu parties got 83% of the vote. Surprise, surprise. But what happened, unfortunately, as a result, is that then in the new country, in the free Rwanda, you, from the very beginning, had a one-party state. There were no multi-parties. There was no room for anybody other than the Hutu party, which is also a recipe for disaster. The Belgians, as I said, kind of flip-flopped. They recognized, they saw the writing on the wall, and they decided that they would then back the Hutu. After this period is one of a lot of clashes, a lot of massacres, mostly, in this case now, Hutu against Tutsi. And many Tutsis left. In fact, this was the first great exodus of refugees in the early 60s. Luther World Federation World Service at that point had a project or had a program in Tanzania as well. And we found it rather strange that 30 years ago we would be dealing with the first wave of Rwandan or Tutsi refugees, and then over the years it was almost like history repeating itself. The parents came, and then 40 years later, 30 years later, the children of the original refugees come again. But that was the first major exodus of Tutsis. Most of the refugees at that time, some of them did come to Tanzania, but most of them went north into Uganda. And there they ran into a very difficult situation because at that time, the leader of Uganda was Idi Amin, another not very nice person. He was then followed by Milton Obote, who was an equally not very nice person. And in Uganda, there started a rebel movement to overthrow Obote. That was led by the current president of Uganda, Museveni, who's a pretty decent fellow. Anyway, the Tutsi refugees decided that they would throw in their lot with the Ugandan rebels to get rid of Amin and get rid of Obote. And what was the result of that was that they got a lot of experience in a very good army. The Ugandan army was very good and, in fact, did overthrow Obote. So the Tutsis learned how to be good fighters, and they learned how to be disciplined, et cetera, et cetera. So they played a very major role. Of course, it helps that they had benefited from their privileged position in Rwanda. They were better educated. They made a very positive contribution to the effort of the Ugandan army. But like what happens to a lot of refugees, they are welcomed, and especially in this case in Uganda, they were welcomed into the army to help the army overthrow Obote. But once Obote was gone, then the Ugandans said, "What are these people doing here? They're not Ugandans." And then the Tutsis again found themselves as refugees, thinking, "No, no, no. We thought perhaps that we could." Enter into Ugandan society and be part of the society, but that's impossible for us now. We helped fight against Obote, but now we're being kicked out of the army, and we really have to go home. So that was a point where this group of Tutsis decided to form what is called the Rwandan Patriotic Front. And that is essentially the army of Tutsis who, after hearing that the genocide had started, moved down from northern Uganda into Rwanda and chased the Hutus out and were responsible for the fact. I mean, at that point, the Hutus ran fearing for their lives because they knew that this Tutsi army, after seeing what had happened to the Tutsis in the genocide, that army would take revenge on them. So that was really the reason why you had so many refugees leaving. Let me stop here and ask you if there are any things that I have said that don't make sense to you or that you would like to ask a question about. Yes?
You mentioned these identity cards. Mm-hmm. You said that this was something introduced by the Belgians.
Yes.
And then when independence came, the Hutus formed their own government.
Mm-hmm.
They retain these identity
cards. They retain the identity cards, exactly.
Is this an instance where their dislike of the Tutsis overcame their dislike of some of the colonial era? Is that why they retain them?
I think they retain them because it was somehow in their interest to retain them. After independence, as I said, the worm turned, and you had the Hutus doing to the Tutsis exactly what the Tutsis had done to them prior to independence. So I think they wanted to retain the identity card so they knew who these people were. There were historical records of almost ethnic cleansing, like we saw in the former Yugoslavia, where the Tutsis were then driven out of the universities. They were, a lot of really bad things like that happened. And of course, the way you know who these people are is you have a copy of their identity card in the local government, so you know exactly where to find them. And that was also very important during the genocide when this was planned. Everyone knew where the Tutsis were. You didn't have to guess. You had these identity cards in the local governments, what we would call, well, I suppose it would be like city government, village government, whatever. They knew where they were. So it was in their interest to keep that identity card, system of identity cards.
Anything? When did they become independent? Was it 1967?
No, it was before that, Maren. I have the, let me look here, I have the exact date. Mm-hmm.
1962.
Yeah, it was independent in 1962. And in 1963 and 64, that was the time when most of the Tutsis fled and went to Uganda. Okay. During that time, violence escalated after 65 up through the 70s, and then the business of the Tutsis being involved in Uganda. Okay.
Can I ask you one other thing?
Mm-hmm.
The Belgians, when did they move in?
The Belgians came, let's see. Around 1916.
Right after World War I.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. World War I.
The Germans were there before.
The Germans were there before. Yeah. They were in 1899 was the date of the Berlin Conference.
Uh-huh.
When Germany was given what is Rwanda. And they held it until the end of World War I. And then the Belgians took over in 1916. Until independence. In 1962. Okay. During this time, the Hutu government, since it was a one-party state, became increasingly corrupt. The president gathered around himself his relatives, close friends, as is the case in many situations. A foreign aid found itself lining the pockets of an elite within the Hutu government. Then you had a situation in the 80s where most of the hard currency that is created for Rwanda comes from the sale of coffee. The coffee prices fell by 75%. So you had a situation where there was a corrupt government, there was economic hardship. By that time, the Rwandan Patriotic Front, those Tutsis who had been in Uganda, who were still in Uganda but had joined the rebel, had started the rebel group, they were making incursions into Rwanda, realizing that the situation was probably not very stable, and that it was a good time to go across the border, make some raids, run back, whatever. They became known. It's interesting that they were called the cockroaches. This was the name that was given to the Rwandan Patriotic Front by the Hutus. And what happened because of that is that there arose in northern, especially in northern Rwanda, a very hardcore Hutu group who had close relationships with the president and were very concerned about keeping political power at all costs. As things got worse, the international community, which up until this had been preoccupied with other things. It had been preoccupied with the fact that the Soviet Union was crumbling and the Cold War was over. So even though everyone knew there were bad things happening in Rwanda and that Hutus were killing Tutsis and vice versa, nobody really paid too much attention because they were thinking about other things or their attention was elsewhere. But soon it became clear, also to many of the surrounding African countries, especially Tanzania, who had been put in the very bad position of having to accept all of these refugees who kept coming as a result of these clashes between the Hutu and the Tutsi. And the Tanzanian government, to its great credit, took a very active role in trying to deal with this situation. There was pressure from the international community, certainly through the United States and Canada and Switzerland, other countries who were providing foreign aid to Rwanda and were saying, we are going to tie our foreign aid to human rights abuses. So there was kind of a convergence by both the international community and by the surrounding African countries to say to Rwanda, look, you've got a problem here. How long can this go on? Isn't there some way that you can that we can solve this problem? Eventually, peace talks began in Arusha, Tanzania, a city in the northern part of Tanzania. The Tutsis were represented in those talks by very good delegation. These people were prepared, they were disciplined, they knew what they wanted, they came to the talks with a very clear agenda. And that agenda called for power sharing in Rwanda, for including Tutsis into the army, for the abolition of the identity card situation. On the other hand, the Hutu delegation, as I would say a reflection of the corrupt government that was then in Kigali, came very unprepared, didn't really know what they wanted to do. In fact, essentially the Tutsis did a number on the Hutu delegation in this in these peace talks. But again, there was this pressure from the outside to finally do something about it. And as the pressure built, the extremist Hutus, again, these northern people from the north who were aligned with the president, realized that if this peace treaty or if this peace agreement was signed and implemented, and the idea was that if it was signed, the United Nations would come in with a peacekeeping force to monitor, to see that the provisions of the treaty were implemented, they would lose power. So they realized that they had nothing to lose, that they were in a position of all or nothing. Because unfortunately, as good as the motives were around this peace accord between the Tutsis and the Hutu, these most extreme Hutu element, and they had now organized themselves into a distinct political party, which was very closely tied to the president, but the president never acknowledged it. It wasn't known that they were very closely allied with the president. The president was saying wonderful things like, yes, we should have this peace agreement, yes, we should do this, da 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 da. But on the side, this most extremist group were really arming for genocide. They realized they had been left out of the peace accord, and this is something that's very important. When you have a group of people like this who are on the political extremes and you're trying to bring together some kind of reconciliation or some kind of power sharing, it's important that even though they may be despicable people and they may say things that you don't agree with, if you eliminate them from the political process, what they will do, since they are then on the fringes and they have nothing to lose, they will do everything they can to blow the peace treaty out of the water, so to speak. And that's exactly what happened. It was unfortunate in that this peace treaty was flawed in that way. You either have to be able to neutralize these people or you have to bring them into the process. If you don't do either of those two, then they will just simply be waiting on the sidelines to do everything they can to upset the apple cart, so to speak. So that's what happened. When the president of Rwanda and the president from Burundi, they flew to Arusha, Tanzania to sign the peace accord. That was on the 6th of April, 1994. And as I've said a number of times, in signing that peace accord, they signed their own death warrant. Because that evening, when the plane was flying back from Arusha to Kigali, one missile was fired at the plane. It crashed, interestingly enough, on the grounds of the presidential palace, and both the president of Burundi and Rwanda were killed, along with the rest of the people in the plane. That was just the signal. At that point, the Hutu extremists, and they had organized themselves into a number of different groups, they went into action. This was just the straw that broke the camel's back, so to speak. They immediately went on the radio and said that the Tutsis had shot down the plane, and therefore the Tutsis should die. And that was the night when the genocide began. It went on for 100 days, and in 100 days, about 500,000 people were killed. That brings us up to the beginning of the genocide. We have a few minutes left. Any other questions at this point for clarification? Or yes?
A little bit. How could you had mentioned yesterday that this could have been prevented? Mm-hmm. Except through hindsight, how do you think we're smart enough to anticipate or that there are ways in which this could have been prevented?
Tomorrow, I'm going to talk about that issue of how it could have been prevented, because I think you may have heard me say yesterday that there was a very serious evaluation of this whole situation done by many of the humanitarian aid agencies that worked with the terrible results of the genocide. And they have laid out a series of incidences where they said, if such and such had happened, we could have avoided it. But I'll go into that tomorrow. Who's to say? It might not have been avoided. But I think that the thing I'd like you to go away with today from the session is an understanding that this was just not some kind of spontaneous outbreak of tribal violence. That it was, in fact, a very well-calculated political move. Certainly playing on the history that was bad. There was a lot of bad history between the Hutu and the Tutsis, but I'll just say something that I would say tomorrow. It's very interesting that when the genocide began, the first people to die were not Tutsis. They were not Tutsis. They were Hutus who had understood that this situation had to stop. They may not have totally agreed with the peace accord, but they realized that Rwanda could not go on this way. These were educated people, they were some human rights activists, they were a moderate group of Hutu that had grown together and had in fact been a real challenge to the current president. So these were the first people that had to be gotten rid of, because they would be the ones, they were the ones who wanted to exist, to coexist with the Tutsis. So they had to be gotten rid of first. So the first people to die were not Tutsis. They were Hutus who held this moderate view and who hoped that there would be a chance for Rwanda to exist as a country where both these ethnic groups could share power and coexist. Yeah.
In listening to this discussion here and more the economic differences between the two ethnic groups, I wonder if a model, how you could have said similar words about the French Revolution, where they executed the ruling class.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we can say the same thing about what Pol Pot did in Cambodia.
That was the Jews.
Yeah, that was the same thing. I mean, it. I don't. My French history is not so good, but certainly in Cambodia, this crazy idea that you had to get rid of anybody who had an education. Maybe some of you were here. I said when I went to Cambodia, I was just astonished to meet a man who had been a teacher, and he told me that. During the Pol Pot regime, the beginning of the Pol Pot regime, when people knew and understood what was going on, anyone who had eyeglasses was killed. If you wore eyeglasses, you were killed because it was assumed that you had enough money to buy glasses. Most people who have eyesight problems in the developing world don't have enough money to buy glasses. So eyeglasses were just an outward manifestation of your social position, and you were killed. So people threw away their glasses. If they were teachers or if they were anything like that, they pretended that they were ignorant, that they were rickshaw drivers or whatever. That was the only way to survive.
I also remember reading in that same instance that immediately before that happened, the army came into the villages and felt very polite and disciplined them. Persuaded the villagers that they no longer needed their arms to protect themselves. Mm-hmm. And over a period of just a few weeks, they gathered all the arms and yeah. Progressed from there.
I think the one circumstance that beyond all other proves that this was not spontaneous is that so many people were killed in such a short period of time. I mean, think about it. 500,000 people killed, and that's the low estimate. In the beginning, they thought it was a million. They said, no, probably 800,000. Then it's gone down. I think it's the general conclusion is now it's about 500 or 600,000 people were killed. You can't kill that many people in 100 days unless you have an organized plan. Really, you have to know who you want to kill. You have to know where they are, and this wasn't systematic gassing like the Nazis did. This was close up killing. There weren't a lot of bullets used. It was mostly machetes and clubbing and whatever. So it's astonishing when you think of it.
Well, was it the Hutus against the Tutus? Was it the Tutus that mostly got killed here?
Yes, all of them, yes. Except Marne, as I said in the beginning, the plan was get rid of the moderate Hutus who want coexistence with the Tutsis.
Right.
Get rid of them. And they also got rid of journalists. They got rid of, again, like we were talking last night, anybody who could kind of protest against what was going on. Get rid of them. We'll talk tomorrow, get rid of the United Nations force. That was very important because you can't have a UN peacekeeping force when you're trying to do genocide. So the plan was you have to get rid of them as well. And I'll tell you how they got rid of them. But then it was totally a massacre, a genocide of the Tutsi ethnic group. Many of them, as I said, many of them had already left. They'd been cleansed from the universities. So now it was time to finish the job. And leading up to this point, again, there were a lot of clues. I think when we say what might have happened, people didn't, they didn't see the clues. They didn't recognize the signs. The radio stations were broadcasting the most incredible hate against the Tutsis that you have ever heard. And I've heard people say, French who were there, other people who were there, there were reports circulating around the diplomatic community that there was a plan for genocide. But I guess in 1994, nobody believed that such a thing could happen. It was just it was beyond their ability to believe that this kind of thing could happen. The quote, the radio station, We're saying things like, even this is during the genocide, when Radio Mil Colones was broadcasting in April 1994, the grave is only half full, who will help us fill it? So you had propaganda, hate propaganda against the Tutsis. It's much like the Jews in the Nazi period. They were the scapegoats. They were in this army of cockroaches up there in the north who were attacking in the north and causing problems. And they were responsible for the economic problems, the collapse of the coffee market. Anything that was wrong in Rwanda was the, whether it was right or wrong. And since there were not that many Tutsis left, it was their fault. It was their fault that the president was killed. It was their fault that this was happening. So then when the orders were given, and there were a lot of structures already on the ground. I'll talk about that tomorrow. Who did the killing and how were they organized? They were ready to go.
I'm also curious to know what the role of the United States was in all of this.
It was up until this point, I think a rather positive one. The U.S., along with the other countries that I was talking about, Canada, the Vatican, a lot of people, they were really pressing. They were pressing for this political process that was taking place in Tanzania that ended with this peace accord. The Security Council of the United Nations had authorized the peacekeeping force that was already in place. There was already a UN force in place in Rwanda. So to keep the peace, to see that the peace accord had a chance for success. So up until this point, it was not a negative role. Perhaps we should have seen more of the signals, the signs, because they were there. And certainly the colonial powers that were most involved in Rwanda, meaning the Belgians and the French, they should have known. But they didn't say much. They didn't do much. Then afterwards, after the genocide started, then there were some very, very serious problems on the part of the United States and the United Nations and a lot of other people. But we'll talk about that tomorrow. Okay. One last question. Yeah.
If the plan by the Hutus early on was to eliminate people who could raise protest, what did they do with all of the, like in Kigali, with all the various embassies there, different nationalities at the embassies? What did they do to the foreigners?
Oh, the foreigners left. I mean, that's the first thing that happens. Because also, at the same time, you have to remember that the Rwandan Patriotic Front, as soon as the genocide started, they moved. They started coming down from the north to try to do everything that they could to stop it. But of course, they had to fight their way down. I mean, they were faced by the Rwandan army, which was the Hutu army at that time. And so almost all the people in the diplomatic corps left. They were evacuated because it was a very dangerous situation.
But were they able to get out, or were they allowed to leave?
Oh, they were allowed to leave. I mean, yeah, that was the other thing. The Hutu government wanted them gone. They wanted everybody out of there so that they could carry out the genocide. They wanted the UN out. They wanted all the foreigners out.
They didn't want witnesses.
They didn't want witnesses. So it was pretty easy to get out of Kigali. And everybody got out. Okay, enough for today. Thank you.
Thank you.